Good afternoon. My name is Billy, and thank you for coming to Concurrent Section 5B. This section is titled Australian Retail TPD, What Have We Learned? So we've got a panel of speakers here. So from left to right is Jason Howe, Dr. Matthew Paul, and Zoe Zong. So this section is about 40 minutes, so we've got 10 minutes in, at the very end of the section for you to ask questions. And before we go, I encourage you to download the app so that you can give feedback for these sections. And also, we'll be doing live poll for these sections. So if you haven't got the app yet, download the app now because you can be able to vote during the section. Before we go, the bios for the speakers, Dr. Matthew Paul is a Chief Medical Officer of Munich Re Australia. He's an occupational physician with 20 years of clinical experience. He specialized in assessment of work capacity, impairment, and disability. He has industry experience within workers' compensation, health insurance, CPT insurance, life insurance, and reinsurance. He became limited in 2011. And Jason Howe has worked in a diverse range of actuarial functions in Australia and New Zealand. He joined Munich Re Australia 4 years ago, where he specialized in setting terms of trade assumptions for lump sum claims and lapses. Recently, Jason relocated to Munich Re's regional office based in Singapore. He is taking up new challenges to review lump sum claims experience across multiple countries. He brings an international lens and in-depth knowledge about the Australian market. And Jason is passionate in finding out insights on observed experience and tracking down drivers behind. And lastly, we've got Zoe. Zoe Zong is a pricing actuary at Munich Re Australia with more than 10 years of experience in life insurance industry. She has gained valuable experience in a range of roles across pricing, valuation, business planning, and management reports. Zoe is passionate about providing sustainable protection, peace of mind, and support to those in need. And without further ado, I'll hand over to Zoe.
Thank you, Billy. Can you hear me? Okay. All right. Thanks, Billy. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming in. And our today's topic is about retail TPD. You might be wondering, why do we want to pick up this product? So the background about this is that late last year, we have observed a deterioration in the retail TPD experience. And we were quite concerned that whether this is a volatility or is this is the new norm, are there any leakages such as anti-selections? So therefore, we have started our investigations, and the retail TPD is a very tricky product. When I used to work in a direct insurer, it is very difficult to find out about retail TPD experience because of the limited volume of data. Even as a reinsurer, while we have the benefits of pooling multiple cedants' experience, we still find that there is limited experience. Across 10-year period, we have about 400 claims. So it is very difficult to draw solid conclusions by just looking at the data alone. And therefore, our learnings are combinations of quantitative analysis as well as qualitative ones. When you hear from our findings, there are some findings may not become a surprise to you, but we hope that we have found some anecdotal evidence that supported anecdotal reasons. And we would like to share with you what we have found. So in our presentation today, what we're going to talk to you about is experience that we have observed on our reinsurer's portfolio. Insights is the main focus of our presentation today. And actions, where possible, what can be quick fixes to improve experience. How did we gain our insights? So we have gained our insights from multiple functional reviews. We have Jason here who looked into experience and a deep dive into what areas of TBD has deteriorated. And then when he find any areas of possible leakages such as anti-selection, Dr. Matt stepped in and reviewed claims files. And we also conducted interviews across all functional areas within our company to collect feedback from underwriting, claims, product and pricing on what they think the drivers are. So before we get started with the experience, we'd like to refresh some of the principle of insurer events with you. Please bear with me for a couple of minutes. I know that some of this is probably very familiar to you, but we might be different by some of the wordings. Later on, we will be asking to seek your opinion and pulling some of your opinion with retail TBD product on the principle of insurability. So what is an insurance? Insurance is when the insured pay a small amount of premium in exchange for the insurance company's promise that in an event that is devastated and possibly a large loss, they will be compensated for. So this insured event should follow the following principles. And what are these principles? They are definable, reasonable, manageable, and rateable. Definable means there should be no room for argument as whether or not a claim should be paid. Reasonable has two components. First component is it covers contingency, so the occurrence should be neither too frequent or too rare, and it should cover for the financial loss that the insured should be neither better off or worse off in the event of claim. And the manageable means loss should be random in nature, else the insured will engage in anti-selection. And the last bit, rateable, is reflecting together with definable, that can we use past experience to predict the future. So I would like to clarify those concepts, and later on we will seek your opinion. So now I will pass over to Jason, who is going to share with you the experience we have observed on the reinsurance portfolio.
Okay, this is the first graph I look at whenever I set assumptions, and basically it shows the actual to expected performance. And what I noticed when I set this was that 2015 and 2016 had a sharp rise in experience. So that generally makes you nervous in an assumption setting perspective because you don't know if it's a trend. You also want to start figuring out what's causing this rise. A bit of background into the graph, the expected basis, we use the IA 2004-8 tables, but we put a couple of adjustments. The adjustments include an age adjustment over age 55, occupational factors, TPD definition factors, which is different for own and ENIOC, and we also apply no select factors on an amounts basis. So next I had a look at individual cedents that make up our portfolio, and these are our four larger cedents. And what was interesting here is that you could see the upward trend was observed in all four cedents. So this makes you think that the upward movement is unlikely to be a single event, and it points to systemic market influence. And Dr. Matt will highlight a lot of these influences later in the presentation. Next, what happened, I was still trying to figure out why have we got this upward movement, and around the office there was a lot of attention to some large own occupation claims. So what I decided to do was plot ONOC and ENIOC separately and to see if ONOC was the sole cause. And as you can see from this graph, both own and ENIOC had adverse experience in the 2015 and 16 period, which also points to a more systemic effect. Important point to notice on this graph is that in the expected basis for ONOC, we have a substantial ONOC loading. Okay. So given that I couldn't isolate the upward movement to ONOC, and there was a lot of talk around the office about how bad ONOC experience was, I decided to perform a statistical test to try to eliminate some bias. So what I did here was I removed the ONOC loading. So now I'm comparing the absolute difference between own and any. And what you can see at a portfolio basis is that both on an amounts basis and account basis, ONOC is statistically worse than ENIOC. These are 95% confidence intervals that we put around our expected basis. The other thing that was interesting is when you look at the individual cedents, none of them were statistically significant because they lack the number of claims. You can see in each of the cases there's strong evidence that ONOC is worse than ENIOC. So one of our hopes is when presenting this is that the pooling effect that we were able to use as a reinsurer helps people with less data make some informed decisions. Next item,
Thanks, Jason. So what Jason have shared with you is the experience that we have observed. And then in the next section, we will talk through our hypothesis on drivers, and we will walk you through individual of the hypothesis. The first hypothesis is, does anti-selection exist? Can we have any evidence around that? Second one is product the issue? And the third one is, if product is the issue and the product has been there for a long time, why did we have the deterioration recently? What is contributing to that? Is there any external factors? So we will go through that in the next couple of sessions. And the hypothesis first is that anti-selection is probably one of the leakage that exists. And I'll pass back to Jason, who will walk you through what has he observed on the data that suggested possible anti-selection.
Okay. So during our annual review process, we look at lots of different rating variables. And the one that caught my eye was the analysis by duration. And what's interesting is that you can see signs of a positive select effect on account, whereas there's much weaker select effects on an amounts basis. So basically, this is saying that the claims that are coming in the early years are of a higher than expected basis. So that is one sign of possible anti-selection. The next thing I did was I wanted to dig into the first year claims to see where this could be coming from. And what was interesting is if you look by the claim causes, we saw in the first year, mental health makes up 48% of the claims, whereas in years durations 1+, it drops down to 22%. If you look at the other claim causes, and we'll take musculoskeletal, you can see that the spread of claims between duration 1 and duration 1+ are much more similar. So at this stage, What I have had is I've had a lot of evidence of anti-selection, but I still don't know if it's anti-selection or pure bad luck. So what I did was talk to Dr. Matt to help me look into the claims.
So I'm going to talk a bit about how we investigated anti-selection, what we found. We're going to go through a specific case example where we think it occurred, and then we're going to talk about some insights to actions, some perhaps recommendations that we can make based on what we found, if you accept it. So how did we investigate whether or not anti-selection was present? Well, we looked at all claims over a 10-year period that met the following criteria. They had to have claimed within the first year of their policy, and they had to have claimed due to a mental health disorder. Now, how many claims met that criteria? Only 10, and so you may be wondering to yourself, well, why am I listening to a presentation where you've reviewed 10 claims? Well, if anti-selection does exist, it should be investigated, it should be understood, and should be controlled. And we hope that what we have found is still interesting to you. So to get some certainty if anti-selection is present, what we do is profile the claim and compare that claim to the profile of the ideal anti-selector. Now, what is an ideal anti-selector? We believe it is somebody who has incentive. Incentive is usually financial, so we're looking at sums insured, and we're also looking at financial risk or stress. We're also interested in product knowledge. Ooh, that E should be up there. Product knowledge would be what allows someone to select a product which would be more likely to result in a successful claim. We're also interested in people working within the insurance industry. Now, we're also interested in people who have the ability to avoid risk characterization. So we're specifically interested in people with subjective symptom disorders. These are notoriously difficult to characterize at underwriting. One of the big groupings of those is a mental health disorders. These conditions generally take a long time to develop before they're diagnosed. There's a long lead time. And so people in this group who all claimed within the first year of their policy, it's a bit unusual that they were suddenly diagnosed with a mental health condition and became disabled within that 12-month gap. So we thought they were interesting to examine. And, of course, we're also interested in people who have perhaps a heightened level of health risk awareness and perhaps some sophistication at ability to avoid risk characterization. And we're talking about health professionals here. And I always wonder if I'm perhaps the ideal anti-selector because I have a bit of product knowledge and a bit of that, and I just lack incentive, and I haven't claimed. So anyway, what we're saying is if all of these features are present, we are perhaps more confident that anti-selection has occurred. So what did we find? Well, we found that there perhaps was some evidence of incentive. We found a larger sum insured, or average sum insured, compared to the portfolio. And we also found four of the claims had an element of financial stress at the time of application, which wasn't fully characterized. In relation to product knowledge, we noted that 6 of the 10 selected an own occupation policy definition, and 3 of them worked within the insurance industry, which we found a little bit interesting. And in relation to the ability to avoid risk characterization, well, as I said, mental health disorders are particularly difficult to characterize, but we noted that 2 of these claims perhaps under-disclosed their mental health past history. And this is what I find most interesting, is that 7 of them had what was called a significant psychosocial stress. So these are things like marriage breakdowns and divorces and family separations and business collapses and legal threats and fraud investigations and someone who is just coming out of bankruptcy, perhaps. So psychosocial distress, it predisposes you to develop a mental health condition, what it can do. So we're interested in the fact that 7 of these people had this feature at the time of their application, but it wasn't fully characterized within underwriting. So we're going to talk through a case where we think anti-selection may have occurred. This is a case of the phobic lawyer, and this is a picture of him filling out his insurance application. So this is a 32-year-old male who lives in Victoria. He's very well educated, completed a law degree, obviously, and then went on and ran his own law firm, only ever worked as a lawyer. He took out $2 million of own occupation TPD insurance. He didn't disclose anything at underwriting and was accepted as a standard risk. So what happened and why do we think anti-selection occurred? Well, this person claimed, and they claimed within 6 months of their policy commencing. We note that 3 months prior to their application, they received a threatening letter from another law firm threatening them legally and also seeking damages, significant damages, in relation to past advice that they had given. They completed their application, and within 2 months, they developed symptoms that led them to go to their GP for the first time, and they were diagnosed with anxiety and depression. Treatment was initiated, and they decided to take a short holiday, and during that holiday they decided to cease work as a lawyer and they gave up their practicing certificate. They returned and saw treatment by a psychiatrist and a psychologist. Multiple different medications were trialed. The depression lifted somewhat, but the anxiety persisted, and he ended up getting diagnosed with a specific phobia of law and legal work. Which is difficult, because it's hard to return someone to their own occupation if they're phobic of it. So this a TPD claim was lodged around 6 months into the policy, and it took a long time to investigate or assess this claim, which caused some customer dissatisfaction and legal threats of his own. But eventually, the claim was accepted, despite the treating doctors confirming that he did have work capacity and you're just not as a lawyer. And we also noted that his business, his legal business, still was operating, yet we had to accept the claim. We feel that this event was particularly significant and wasn't particularly well assessed at under, or even attempted to be assessed, and perhaps predisposed him to develop this condition. Anyway, so in relation to insights to actions, we've noted that incentive is important, and high sums insured tends to incentivize anti-selection. So one control for that to consider is to perhaps reduce the maximum sum insured limit. And we can talk about that later in the question session if you wish. And in relation to risk selection, we don't believe that we believe that there are missing risk controls, and we can enhance those by perhaps examining financial distress and psychosocial stress more thoroughly at underwriting stage. I would, at this stage, ask you to consider these principles of insurability, and we're going to come back to this towards the end of the presentation, but do you believe that TPD insurance, especially own occupation TPD insurance, meets this principle of reasonableness, where someone might be better or worse off after their claim or than not? And then manageability, the risk should be, or the loss should be, random in nature, where some people appear to be almost predisposed to claim. Anyway, on that note, I'm going to pass you back to Zoe, who's going to talk through some product issues.
Yep. Thanks, Dr. Matt. So I'll go through some of the product issues that we have found through interviews with underwriting and claims. And the product is a broad topic. So over here, we particularly choose two features that are relevant to the retail TPD. And the first feature is eligibility criteria. In this one, we're in particularly interested in the occupation listing that we're offering to own-occupation TPD. Own-occupation TBD is, in fact, very specific. So over here, we have a couple of heavy blue collars. By their day-to-day jobs, they are doing a lot of heavy lifting, bendings, and it is inherently that they will have a lot of risk to their back, and they will easily have sore back that prevents them return back to work. So in the group space, our understanding is that own-occupation TBD is not offered to heavy blue collar workers, while as in retail TPD, there seems to be a view that underwriting is able to write the risk effectively. However, the feedback that we have received from underwriters are that if somebody is perfectly healthy and then they pass all these exclusions, loading criteria, we have to accept them as standard risks. So even though underwriters knew that the chances of these people become disabled, the risk is really high, they are unable to decline them or apply loadings. So that's one of the takeaways. And this does not only apply to heavy blue-collar workers, it also applies to people like chiropractors. If they injure their fingers, then they may not be able to practice. However, they can still do trainings and a running business. One interesting finding that we have also observed, which we will later share with you when we do international comparison, is that our colleagues from South Africa has observed similar issues. So in South Africa, there has been a constantly push in the market to push the boundary beyond the principle of insurability. And they are writing business own occupation TPD to sports people. And then the feedback from our colleagues is that the insurers who are writing own occupation TBD to those occupations experience worse experience. So in the next one is insights into action. So our insight is we think own occupation TBD in the past has extended beyond the principle of insurability, where the occupations whose risk of disablement is very high are being accepted. So one of the actions that we suggested is to review occupation listing under own occupation definition. Later on, we will be asking your opinion whether you think that offering own occupation TBD to these occupations meets the principle of reasonableness. Now I'm going to pass back to Dr. Matt, who is going to share with you the second issue on product.
So we've noticed product definition weakening over years. We've seen word substitution. So within the TPD definition, the word unable has been substituted for the word unlikely in relation to return to work. We've also seen legal challenges to the concept of education, training, and experience. And we're going to talk a bit about a claim that demonstrates that soon. And we've also, as a result of legal challenges, seen claims assessors having to assess the labour market when determining the likelihood of return to work. And so it really asks the question, what are we insuring? Are we insuring medical, occupational disability, or more of a socio-economic outcome? So this case is the case of the plumber in pain. This man is currently 58 years old. He is living in New South Wales, and he took out $1.9 million of any occupation TPD insurance. He wasn't eligible for own occupation TPD insurance. Interestingly, his education training and experience was very limited. He'd only ever completed high school and then gone on and worked as a plumber for decades and ran his own business. Now, he declared a few relatively minor health issues at underwriting and was accepted as a borderline standard risk. So what happened with this gentleman? Well, his policy commenced in 2011, and in 2014, he developed the slow onset of lower back pain. There was no trauma, no accidents, and back pain is very common, especially in as you get older and especially in heavy manual workers, which is perhaps one reason why they don't get offered own occupation TPD. So he went to see his GP and had some conservative treatment and had an investigation which showed degenerative lumbar spine disease. He continued to work, but next year the pain became much worse and radiated down his leg, and he had to stop work because he had difficulty bending and lifting and pushing and pulling, all inherent requirements of his role. And shortly after he stopped work, his business closed down, which is quite a common occurrence in people who run these kinds of businesses. And that means he's got no job to go back to. He eventually saw an orthopedic surgeon who tried a series of injections and then surgery, which didn't provide any long-lasting relief, and that's also quite a common occurrence. And so by 2016, he lodged a TPD claim, and this again was thoroughly assessed, and vocational rehabilitation providers got involved, and they found that he did have functional capacity to perform a lighter role, and they recommended a role such as a plumbing retail sales assistant at Bunnings, for example. And so the any occupation TPD claim was disputed. However, the claim had to be accepted because of legal interpretations in relation to education, training and experience, where there has to be a direct link between someone's past work experience and the proposed return to work options, and this person didn't have any of that. So this is a case where someone who wasn't eligible for an own occupation TPD policy and took out any occupation TPD policy, but at claim time had to be assessed against essentially an own occupation TPD definition. So in terms of insights to actions, we believe that this scenario is not uncommon, and a number of people will also be assessed against own occupation TPD definitions when they don't have them. And we would recommend a review of occupational disability definitions to clear up some of the uncertainty. And we'd ask you to consider whether or not you think TPD generally meets this insurability principle of being definable. Is there room for argument as to whether or not a claim meets the definition provided? All right, so this is a beautiful picture, but this is a challenging environment that we're in. There are stormy waters, and it's our opinion that there are several features underneath the water which will perpetuate this challenging environment unless they're addressed. One of them, of those features, is this rise in subjective health conditions. There are things like mental health disorders and chronic pain. They're both very prevalent. They both affect 20% of the population, and they're highly disabling. There's a lot of disability associated with them. And clinically, subjective conditions are very difficult to assess. There's no objective measure of them, so you're never certain that they are present, and you're never certain that they're as severe as someone says they are and as disabling as someone says they are. And so when someone goes to claim, the claims assessor inherits that uncertainty, and that is also made worse by the fact that they're assessing disability against a pretty subjective definition themselves. So what happens as a result of that? Well, claims assessments take a long period of time, and there's a high risk of adverse outcome for the claimant. And that is not a particularly great customer experience. And it all sort of boils down to this issue about definability, about this disagreement about whether or not the claim condition is present and whether or not they meet this definition. So we also have a bit of a concern about what you call perhaps moral hazard, which is during this long investigation period, we're essentially requiring these people to prove continuously that they're disabled and not participate in rehabilitation and recovery efforts, which could be detrimental to their health because there's lots of evidence that supports a return to work as part of treatment nowadays. So we worry about that as well. So to sort of summarise how all this affects our current environment, we believe that this principle of definability is the root cause and that TPD doesn't meet this, and that causes customer dissatisfaction. And then that causes, you know, unhappy customers go to the media, unhappy customers go to their lawyers, unhappy customers caused the FSC to introduce LICOP, which has several recommendations, and most of those don't address the root cause. They perhaps limit claims investigations to a degree. There was an ASIC review also in relation to customer dissatisfaction, and they made a range of recommendations, including for insurers to publish claims acceptance rates. And that might fuel anti-selection itself, and it might cause insurers to compete against each other on high acceptance rates. The Parliamentary Joint Committee has made a range of recommendations which will probably further limit underwriting and claims assessment. Interestingly, they made the recommendation to review all insurance definitions and perhaps move to standardised ones, and maybe that's an opportunity to take action. And then there's the Royal Commission, which we'll leave alone at this point in time. What we've also noticed is the brand damage. So brand management and brand concerns are creeping into claims assessment decisions. And this is also fueled by this underlying customer dissatisfaction, which we think is related to the fundamental issue with the product, that it's very unclear when you meet this defined state. So on that very down note, I will pass you back to Zoe, who will talk about what we learned again.
Thank you, Dr. Matt. So what we have shared is our hypothesis on the possible drivers. So the first possible driver is there are evidence leakage such as anti-selection exists. And the second one, we think fundamentally the product that we're offering in retail TPD does not meet the principle of insured event. And then this product issue contributed to the current challenging environment that we're in today, which in turn contributed to the experience that we have observed. So in this next little section, what we're going to do is to put all these observations into perspective. And we'd like to share with you the combination of these. How does Australian's retail TPD product compare to overseas? And also, we wanted to share with you an example if good fundamentals can work. Is Australian alone with the current issues that we are facing? To answer this question, we have reached out to our global colleagues, and we have asked them a couple of questions around the product eligibility, the product definition and eligibility criteria. We know it is difficult to compare a product across different countries, so we sent through very specific questionnaires and are trying to benchmark as much as possible. So on the left-hand side, you have got Australian, which has, unsurprisingly, under the box of unsustainable product. And together with us is South Africa. So we've briefly touched about South Africa. They have similar products as we have, and then their market is currently pushing the boundary for the eligibility criteria to expand who is eligible for own occupation. So not surprisingly, the feedback from our South African colleague was that they have seen signs of anti-selection, and also they have seen subjective conditions are being paid out. In the middle, we have New Zealand. New Zealand is currently moving towards Australia in some of the product definitions. However, in our view, they are not here yet because they have average low sum insured. New Zealand also does not have a litigation culture, so there are less legal challenges in New Zealand, and their ending occupation TBD are still being paid out as ending occupations. On the right-hand side, the more sustainable part, what we have is Germany, such as Western Europe, and then they offer TPD as activities of daily life working only. So that's part of their trauma product. They do not offer own occupation TPD or any occupation TPD. And then we also have UK together with European Union. And I personally find the learnings from UK is quite interesting. There's a couple that I would like to share with you. So first of all, UK has got a sum insured factor as part of their trauma product. So their TBD is part of a trauma product. And the sum insured that they're going to be offering is a percentage based on the person's age. So therefore, the older the person is, which, for example, in the plumber case, the plumber will be paid out because of his age, that he's unlikely to find any other job. UK have similar case law challenges, but they will not offer such a high sum insured to this type of insured. And then secondly, UK also have a clearer definition around TPD. So for example, they have very clear definition about what is permanency, what is disability, and what is occupation. In addition, they also have some risk mitigates, such as if the product is based on occupation, and when someone is changing their occupation, the insured will be able to state in their PDS around what's going to happen when someone changes their occupation. Also, if someone make a claim when they are in inactive employment, one of the larger insurers in UK will revert this person back to ADL definition rather than an own occupation definition. So there's a couple of learnings that we'd like to take away from there. And now I'm going to be passing back to Jason, who's going to share with you an example when good fundamental can work.
Okay, so this is an example of a simple TPD product that's sold in New Zealand. And the key features of the product is that it's sold on an unable definition. They only sell any OC cover, and the sum assured's low. And the biggest results you can see against the Australian basis, it's generally better. And probably the more interesting result is that if you look at the claim cause allocation, there's musculoskeletal, which is similar to Australia, but we don't see any mental health. Now, in this big unknown, that's a data issue, but I've confirmed if there is mental health, it'll either be between 0 or 6% of the claim causes. So biggest takeaway for me from this is that when you have a more definable and less subjective eligibility criteria, we're having less subjective claim outcomes.
Okay, thank you, Jason. So we'd like to seek your opinion on the principle of insured event. Could you please have a look at your mobile phone app? There are four questions up there. Can we get your vote on your opinion of where you think the Australian retail TPD product meets the principle of insured event? So there are four questions.
Oh,
it's not here anymore.
What happened?
Is this your USB?
No, that's your USB.
So I wouldn't be able to show the results. It should be in the last slide.
You got it?
No.
I've got the USB if you need it.
No. Sorry, we might have some technical
issues.
Sorry.
Please bear with us.
Can't go back.
Can you vote?
Yeah, okay. Sorry, we were going to share with you the link of the results, but looks like that we don't have it in this version of the slides.
Is that the previous presentation?
Yeah, this is the previous presentation.
Thanks. Fingers crossed.
Sorry, guys.
Maybe you could just push on.
Yeah. So we probably won't be able to share with you the results. Sorry about this. We will talk to the organizer to see if there's any opportunity to share with you. But we still appreciate if you could vote.
You could do a show of hands.
Show of hands?
Yeah, sorry.
Okay. Do you guys want to do a show of hands? So the first question is, do you think Australian retail TBD meets the principle of definable? That is, there is no room for argument as to whether or not a claim meets the definition of an insured event. So could we have a hands up if anyone think it meets? Okay, cool. Do you think that it's reasonable, the current retail TBD product, that is, it covers the contingency, not too frequent or too rare, and also the insured is not better off or worse off after receiving the insured event? Do we have anyone think that it meets the definition? It meets this principle?
One, two, three, four, cool.
Thank you. The next one is manageable. Do you think the loss is random in nature, else the insured may be engaged in anti-selection? So who think it meets this principle?
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven.
Cool. Excellent. Eight. Thank you. And one last one is rateable. Do you think the risk is measurable using statistics and ideally past experience? Yes. Okay, cool.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, that's very similar to what we have in a view. We think the last one is the one that's probably sitting somewhere in the middle. Cool. Thanks, everyone. Let's just recap what we have discussed with you. So first of all, on experience, we think that we have observed an increase in retail TBD claims over the last 2 years. And the increase is in both any and own occupation TBD. There is worse in own occupation TBD. On the insights, our deep dive has confirmed possible signs of anti-selection, and we think that fundamentally it is the retail TBD product features that does not meet the principle of insured event is contributing to this, which also contributing to the current legal challenges that we're in and which fuse the current experience that we have observed. So ideally, the solution might be to fix the product, but we know it's going to be taking a quite long lead time and it is resource constrained. So therefore, we have prepared some takeaways, suggested next steps if you're interested to fix the problem as a quick fixes. We know that these fixes may not solve all the problems, but we hope that it may help with some interim solutions. So for example, to combat anti-selection, what we have suggested here are, for example, restrict large sum insured to ADL basis, or we could do something similar to UK, reduce sum insured for when age increases to align with the income replacement needs, or to have a look at when somebody have both DI and TBD to make sure that there is no over-insurance. We also suggested that there could be ways to enhance risk controls, such as include financial underwriting. And then for eligibility criteria, we have suggested that there could be possible to review the occupation listing, such as restrict on-occupation TBD offering to heavy blue-collar workers. And one last bit but not least, tighten some of the weak product definition. So for example, review how occupational disability is being defined and also include retraining and rehabilitation in some of the occupation TPD. The feedback from our claims people is that this retraining and rehabilitation may be more effective for young people and manual workers, so it will not resolve all the issues, but we hope that we can have some takeaway for you guys when you go back to your office on Wednesday. If you're interested, could have a think about these steps. Thank you. So I'll pass back to Billy for opening to questions.
A few minutes for some questions from the audience. So if you've got any questions, please come to the microphone.
Questions?
You talked to us about the 10 early claim cases, but did you look at other aspects with your TPD experience? Some of the sorts of things I was thinking about is where you have either a long delay between the event that causes the TPD and when it's actually notified, and if you're seeing that sort of thing happening, or because group maybe is betting you get quiet, maybe the solicitors that have all been advertising in the group space have now come to find individual claimants, and so are you getting more claims being lodged by lawyers than by individuals? Those other sorts of drivers that may be suggestive of some of the behaviours going on. There's been those court cases that have changed It was, I think, a science teacher up in northwestern Tasmania who claimed TPD because he was unable to work. Mm. There was no school nearby to teach physics, and he shouldn't have to travel 200 kilometres.
Why
it became unlikely to be able. And in the old days, we used to have solely because of sickness or injury. Which maybe we should go back to those old definitions.
So the legal challenges certainly seem to indicate that we've lost control of what we're trying to ensure. And in relation to one of your points, we certainly anecdotally have noticed increased legal representation at claim time with the first claim notification. A letter from one of our favourite law firms comes in. In relation to the late notifications, they certainly are interesting. I don't know if...
I think we reviewed it last year, and like our IBNR pattern hadn't really changed, but it could have in the last year. It's not so. At that last year, it was not no real change in our pattern.
Dennis Wilkinson, in one of the earlier sessions, we had quite a discussion about putting the customer first. When we go through these discussions, we're thinking about we have a problem because we've got an increased level of claims. Let's tighten the definitions. Let's make the benefit payment applicable in less circumstances.
Mm.
How do we marry those two things together and avoid the accusation that we're getting right at the moment that we're moving towards junk insurance where it's almost impossible to make a claim?
Yeah, that's a very good point. So what we're suggesting is not necessary to tighten up the definition when customer is in need. So what we're suggesting is when there is a, for example, own occupation TBD, where if you're paying, if a claim is being paid out and somebody is using that $2 million to do a home renovation, those are the cases that we're targeting. So if we think back to the fundamentals of TBD, is this for someone who has a severe disability? And in those cases, we think that we should be covering for them. And then those needs to be sustainable. It needs to be priced at a reasonable price for customer to have those covers.
Yeah, and it's not, you could also argue that it's not very customer-centric to have them claim for TPD, for them to believe that they're TPD and be assessed against a very unclear subjective definition and then be told that they're not TPD. Their uncertainty, I think, is not customer friendly.
Yeah.
So I think that the customer should be clear when they claim that, yes, I meet that claimed condition. The claims assessor should also be clear, yes, that person meets the claimed condition. And that's, I think, the most customer friendly outcome. And that would involve making that definition a little bit more objective, right? Not necessarily tighter, but I don't know, maybe.
I think one more comment is that with that type of rise in claims costs, you can almost guarantee prices will be going up. So what I worry about is that most people that truly need TPD won't be able to afford it. And we're seeing a lot of claims that, you know, I think most people would say we shouldn't be paying, so I think that's an equity issue between policyholders.
Shubham Saxena from Pricing Actuary at TAL. Thank you for this presentation. So I just want to pull together the elements of this presentation. So first, we saw that claim incidence rates for retail TPD were rising up. So I feel there shouldn't be any expectations for incidence rates to remain flat. Like, you know, as products evolve, as we launch new products in the market, as we cover more benefits, claim incidence rates would rise. The other element is whether the price reflects the right product that we're offering in the market. So, and then I want to combine the second element, which is anti-selection. I think life insurance is a pretty big market in Australia, retail TPD included in that comment. There will be some leakages where some customers might anti-select, but there are also going to be many customers that we're going to provide the right cover to, which includes providing them the high sum insured, which they need. So then the element in there is whether we're applying the right selection discount from a reinsurance perspective or whether that selection discount needs to be reassessed. And then the third element is the product design, which I would like to reaffirm that point, that the product design is really designed on the back of what customers are telling us. And then I would like to ask you this question, like, how would you feel customers would respond to those recommendations which you just...
What was the last part?
How customers might respond to those recommendations?
To the recommendations the made on the last slide?
Occupations, yeah.
Quite a lot of
questions. I think customers would respond well.
Yeah, I think it comes back to the trust. So those recommendations are trying to target some of the issues that we have observed where, for example, we talked about customers' experience when there's uncertainty. Yeah, sorry, why do you have any questions? Yeah, so there is a question about uncertainty. And then therefore, those are the areas where we are looking at to improve customers' experience. And also at the same time, we can provide them with protections that, you know, when somebody is really in need. So if someone is going to be a severe disablement and they need to have care to be provided, then we think that's the product original purpose. So the question is, are we still serving the customer the original intention of the product? And also the customer have other products such as disability income. So a combination, a whole suite of protections that we are offering is what we are aiming for rather than looking at those fixes individually. So Hua, do you have a question? Sorry.
Hua Boy from KPMG. I want to, I guess, pick up the question from Dennis and also the issues that are raised here today. As an actuary, I could see why you make those recommendations, but I also think that the customer perspective is really important, and I think what's missing from the life insurance industry and actuaries is the articulation of the affordability of the cover and the need to basically avoid spurious payment. I don't think that as an industry, I'm saying we as a royal we, so I'm part of it, we're not articulating that affordability question very well. Throughout the 2016 ASIC claims review, there was no articulation of that issue from us.
Yep.
I'd
agree. Controversial.
I think historically TPDs generally cross-subsidised other benefits. So you could argue historically it was priced too high, but companies needed to keep that margin to cover other business. The problem is now that margin is being eroded. So I guess in terms of the customer point, there's lots of... We're not saying you can't cover blue-collar workers. We're saying you can't cover them under... Well, it's difficult to cover them under own occupation. Mm. Under a good any occupation definition, we don't have a problem. And if you look at the occupation listings now, like if you're a policeman, you can't get TPD cover. So we currently exclude a lot of occupations, but with the way the market's moved, is some of the ones that we've let in don't seem to make good insurable interest, which is driving up the price.
Thank you very much for the presentation and the question and the discussions. I think that leaves us some very good food for thought. And can you please join me in a round of applause for these three presenters? Thank you.
Well done.